The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Banished today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Reporter Nick Casey was sent by the New York Times to cover the crisis in Venezuela. Soon he was getting extra attention from the authorities.
It began not long after I came to the country, and the government started to intimidate me, as they do to many reporters.
Finally, he got kicked out of the country.
Mind you, this is much more terrifying if you're a Venezuelan and you don't have anywhere else to go.
And later, what it's like to write fortunes for a company that churns out 4.5 million fortune cookies a day.
I've been pressured to be more productive, to write more. It's not as easy as some people would think.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World.
Think, darling, think. There must be something really rotten we can do today.
We're thinking. But the new head of communications at the White House, Anthony Scaramucci, seems to have cornered that market since yesterday. Still, we've got a few schemes for you today here on the show, including a remembrance of the woman behind the voice of Natasha from Rocky and Bullwinkle, and a few words from around the globe that captured the past week.
Cartel. Corruption.
Cricket queens.
Sanksi, which means in Russian, sanctions.
We'll explain those words a little later. Right now, we kick off with something that really is rotten, the political crisis in Venezuela. The government there is moving ahead with a referendum this weekend. The vote is to choose members of a body that would rewrite the Constitution. Critics around the world say it's a power grab by President Nicolas Maduro, so the opposition has called for a fresh round of protests against him. The government has tried to ban all protests before the vote and has threatened long prison sentences for anyone who defies the ban. So there will likely be more arrests, more violence, and more chaos in the streets of Venezuela through the weekend. And more than 100 people have already been killed in clashes between protesters and police over the past 4 months. It's not just a political crisis in Venezuela. It's a humanitarian one, too.
It was pretty incredible and also really sad to see what happened to Venezuela.
That's Nick Casey of the New York Times. He covered Venezuela for 8 months last year before he was ejected from the country. We'll get to that later. But those 8 months that Nick was in Venezuela, they were crucial moments in the country's slow downward spiral.
For years, Venezuela had been one of the most prosperous countries in Latin America. You have to always remember, and sometimes it's hard to, that this country sits on more oil reserves right now than Saudi Arabia does. When I got there, though, the price of oil had started to collapse, and oil is basically what the government fuels itself off of. This is how Hugo Chavez was able to implement all of his reforms and provide more education, healthcare, and housing. All of that was suddenly starting to decline extremely rapidly when I got there. So I would just wake up in Caracas, as most everybody else would, and you would start to see lines of people forming for food, really long lines, standing in front of grocery stores. And often at the end of that line, there wasn't any food, but just one product that the government might have been selling that day, which was something like cooking oil that you couldn't even eat. And as the year went on, you got to see like this pressure keg of the country beginning to get even more hot. There began to be people who were leaving the country, not just on foot, but he also did a story where I interviewed people that were going on boats to try to leave the country, getting to places like Curacao, an image which was very much reminiscent of some of the most, dark times in Cuba and in Haiti when people were trying to flee those places by boat. There were also patients in hospitals. We did a story on psychiatric patients that didn't have any medicine. The country couldn't import any of these medicines that it didn't make anymore. And mental health patients were literally sitting in mental asylums, like sinking deeper into psychosis, seeing hallucinations, having to be tied to chairs so they wouldn't hurt themselves or attack medical staff. These were the scenes that were becoming just daily scenes in Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, the crisis has really seeped into every corner of Venezuelan society. Did you have Venezuelan friends that you were watching as they went hungry or maybe needing to see a doctor? And what was that like, especially as you, as a foreigner, you were able to bring in food and other necessities?
Well, almost every time that I left Venezuela, and my job when I was living there took me all around the region because I don't just cover Venezuela, I would get messages from people asking me to bring back medicine And sometimes the names of the medicines were extremely basic. It was terrifying sometimes, just what you couldn't get. The other thing that I often saw was, not long after making a friend, that friend would often leave the country, especially people who are my age. I'm in my early 30s. Almost everybody in their early 30s who possibly can is trying to get out. So you'd get to know someone, and then suddenly they said, like, I'm going to Colombia, or I'm going to try to, you know, go to Chile and see if I can't just start my life there again. People who were in the next generation up had often made their decision to stay because they had house, property. That's where everybody that they knew and their family was. And this was even more frustrating for them sometimes, because those people began to feel trapped and that they have to stay and remain in the country no matter where it goes.
Nick, why did you get kicked out of Venezuela?
Well, it began not long after I came to the country, and the government started to intimidate me, as they do to many reporters. One of the early events was that Diosdado Cabello, who is one of the most powerful politicians from the left in the country, put a picture of me on TV, as he does to a lot of journalists in Venezuela. Mind you, this is much more terrifying if you're a Venezuelan and you don't have anywhere else to go. And right. A powerful leftist puts a picture of you on television and says, you know, this person is not to be trusted. This person is close to the opposition and close to the imperialists who are trying to bring the country down. You know, that began, you know, the country has a really large network of Twitter trolls, and sent them extremely aggressively, you know, after me online, in other forms.
Was there one specific thing that you wrote that really got the government's hackles up?
We don't know. The thing is, with governments like this that are completely untransparent, it's not clear what their thinking is. I wrote about the hospital collapse in the country, in which there were people which, you know, couldn't get basic chemotherapy medicines, and many times were blaming the country for this. We wrote about, you know, hunger and how the country was having to, you know, keep National Guardsmen close to the food trucks so people wouldn't loot and riot them. And I think it was kind of the culmination of all these things that were coming out very frequently on the front page of the New York Times that began to irk the government, because really, instead of trying to fix the problems that were going on in Venezuela, from the hunger to the lack of medicine, to the lack of food, they decided to come after the journalists who were starting to actually make the world aware of what was going on. And when I was coming back to the country from Mexico in late October, beginning of November, they stopped me at the border, and they said that I would no longer be able to use my visa to get into the country, a visa which was valid and still had many months left on it before I would even need to renew it. I was forced to stay in the airport that entire night with a guard looking over me, and then I was put on the next flight to Bogota. And from there, I was deported on to New York. And that was the last time that I've been able to get into the country. And, you know, since then, have not been able to even collect my belongings.
So, Nick, as you watch, as you continue to watch these massive upheavals in the country you used to cover, what are you afraid is going to happen to Venezuela?
A lot of smart people who have watched Venezuela for years now are starting to talk about some kind of wider civil conflict potentially taking place. The question is, how long can you keep protesters protesting peacefully on the streets if the government refuses to listen to them and their response has just been that we're going to rewrite the entire constitution in our favor? A lot of people are really beginning to worry that the opposition is starting to set up a parallel government right now. What they would do if that parallel government decided to get arms. I think one of the more absurd moments in this battle that's been going on for the last 3 months in Venezuela, but also one which is rather scary, was when this this police officer took control of a helicopter, flew it around Caracas, and started shooting grenades and firing into government buildings. No one was hurt or killed in this. But he continued to go on to the internet making videos telling Venezuelans that they need to start rebelling. Now, you know, this guy's kind of become a folk hero in Venezuela because he's this very suave, dapper guy who used to be a former actor in some films in Venezuela. And because no one was hurt, you know, people kind of have shrugged it off. But I think attacks like these, there could be more of them. And you know, some of these could actually be deadly. And if they're deadly and the government responds to them, then you start the escalation of violence that I think everybody has been fearing in Venezuela.
Nicholas Casey with the New York Times, currently based out of Bogota, Colombia, former correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The diplomatic spat is on. Today, Russia announced it will expel hundreds of U.S. diplomats in retaliation for the new U.S. sanctions against Russia that Congress signed off on this week. The World's Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. So what exactly is Russia doing, Charles?
Well, today we got a statement on the foreign ministry website that said that Russia is demanding that the U.S. embassy, first of all, vacate a country residence that they have here, as well as a storage facility by next week. In addition, and maybe more importantly, the statement calls on the U.S. to reduce its embassy staff by September 1st to 455 people. That's the same number of Russian diplomats currently in the U.S., but of course it means a big reduction in the staff here at the U.S. embassy in Moscow.
It's kind of amazing. This sounds almost exactly like what Obama did in the last days of his administration, retaliating for Russia's meddling in the election, expelling diplomats, seizing two diplomatic properties of theirs on U.S. soil. I mean, we were all surprised that Putin didn't retaliate for that.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is, well, formally, this is taken in response to this new U.S. sanctions bill, which, of course, is not into law yet. It depends on what Donald Trump decides to do and whether there's an override, if there's a veto. But the measures, in effect, mirror exactly what President Obama did last December when he kicked out these Russian diplomats. He confiscated this Russian diplomatic compound, one in Maryland, one in New York. And these moves were, you know, intended, of course, to punish the Kremlin for this alleged interference in the U.S. presidential elections. As you mentioned, at the time, Putin decided not to respond, kind of turned the other cheek, which was viewed as sort of a gesture to the incoming Trump White House, which, of course, candidate Trump throughout the campaign saying he wanted better relations with Russia.
So why is Putin now going all tit for tat?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, the Russian response comes just a day after Putin warned essentially that Russian patience was running out. His spokesman today said that the Russian leader had personally approved this foreign ministry decision. And essentially, it seems as though they've just come to the conclusion that Trump is sort of neutered on this front. I mean, whether Donald Trump approves this bill, as there's a lot of pressure for him to do, of course, within his own party, that's one aspect. And even if he doesn't, then the Congress can override that decision. And so the sense is that, you know, Trump, for all the talk of trying to reset relations, essentially can't do it. He can't pull it off. And there's just a frustration and an admission that that's just not going to happen.
I mean, you could see this as a spat between Trump and Putin. On the other hand, Putin seems to be getting what he wants from the U.S. in terms of Syria, in terms of respect from the administration. So are they really at loggerheads, or is this smoke and mirrors?
Well, it might be a bit of both, but I think you're right in the sense that there is the risk here that they're alienating essentially the one person in Washington who doesn't seem to think that Russia was interfering in the U.S. elections. So in that sense, you know, they may be like casting aside this one chance for some kind of relationship with Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump that, you know, seemed to go pretty well if you look at their meetings during the G20 for all the attention on these extra unreported meetings, et cetera. You know, the Russians came out of that feeling as though they had some kind of rapport. But clearly they think now that essentially the Washington establishment, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats or what they like to call here the deep state, is preventing Donald Trump from being Donald Trump and pursuing this better relations with Moscow that he says he wants.
The World's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks very much, Charles.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up, the corruption scandal in Pakistan claims a prime minister. It's the World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The World in Words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. A big change in Pakistan today. The Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, was forced to resign after the Supreme Court disqualified him from holding office. The court said Sharif had been dishonest by not disclosing earnings from a Dubai-based company when he filed his nomination papers. It's all part of a corruption scandal sparked by revelations that came out of the Panama Papers in 2015. Sharif has consistently said he did nothing wrong. Meantime, his party plans to name a new prime minister tomorrow. My BBC colleague Sikandar Kermani has more.
Supreme Court. کورٹ نے نواز شریف کو نااہل قرار دے دیا ہے.
Pakistani TV channels breathlessly reported today's unprecedented Supreme Court ruling. For opponents of the Prime Minister, the decision to disqualify Nawaz Sharif marks a huge victory for accountability in a country plagued by corruption scandals. The panel of judges decided he had not been honest when explaining his and his family's financial dealings to a corruption inquiry. A key allegation against Mr. Sharif concerns four luxury flats in central London that leaked documents linked to a number of his children. Critics of Mr. Sharif allege the properties were bought with money earned through the proceeds of corruption. The leader of the opposition PTI party, Imran Khan, said it was a day of celebration for Pakistan.
Today I am happy for Pakistan, but I could see for the first time that the Supreme Court had taken a decision against a sitting, a powerful Prime Minister who's been in power for the past 30 years, who had control over all institutions in Pakistan.
Some of Mr. Sharif's allies have suggested the allegations are an attempt by the country's powerful army to oust him. He and his family have denied any wrongdoing. Outside the court, the Minister for Information, Maryam Aurangzeb, struck a defiant tone.
No matter who becomes the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister in the hearts of the Pakistani people will always be Mohammad Nawaz Sharif.
Mr. Sharif and his children now face a trial by the National Anti-Corruption Body. It's not immediately clear who will succeed Mr. Sharif, but reports suggest his brother Shahbaz, the current chief minister of Punjab province, is one of the strong contenders.
That was my colleague at the BBC, their Pakistan correspondent, Sikandar Kermani. At least Pakistan still has a functioning government. You can't say the same about Yemen. They've endured so much in the past 3 years. A modest checklist here. The civil war there has killed 10,000 people. The Saudi-led military campaign with backing from the U.S. has cut off access to Yemen, so it's a struggle to get food aid into the country, and many people are starving. The people who work for water departments, sewage, garbage collection, and schools, they haven't been paid since last fall. And now the World Health Organization says Yemen's cholera epidemic may have infected more than 400,000 people. Filmmaker Martin Smith brought a film crew into Yemen recently for PBS Frontline. So take us there, to Sana'a, the capital, Martin. This was your first day. What did it look like? What did you see?
Well, as soon as you approach the airport and begin your landing, you see the hulks of destroyed airplanes all burned out and bombed out on the runway. And then you get into town and you see what looks like, you know, a very poor city, but you see bustling, you see people about, you see markets open, but you see a lot of garbage. And it's the garbage that has been the problem causing the cholera epidemic.
This is interesting because, I mean, not getting your garbage collected, that's just a function of government kind of in collapse. But this is connected to salaries not being paid. And as you say, you connect that to the cholera outbreak. Just connect the dots for us. And does the science bear this out?
Yeah, it absolutely does. So you have garbage piling up on the streets, and then you have the rains coming. The rains wash through the garbage, and you get bacteria into the water supply, or kids will play in and around the garbage and infect themselves by touching the bacteria. So it starts to spread, and as long as people in the sanitation department aren't being paid, the garbage doesn't get picked up, and you have a spread of the epidemic.
And with hospitals damaged, how are the people who have cholera, who've gotten sick, how are they coping?
Well, it's a problem. It's a problem mostly outside of the capital. You see more hospitals that have been destroyed outside the capital than you do in Sana'a itself. But we were in a hospital in Sana'a on one of our first days there, and they were absolutely packed. They were having to release patients before they were really healthy, because they had to make room for those that were in worse condition. So they were running out of medical supplies, they were running out of beds, and the nurses and doctors hadn't been paid in 8 months.
I mean, cholera can kill people, and if they don't die, they can be in a really bad state of affairs for a while. What's that done to morale in the middle of this whole bombing campaign?
Well, as you can imagine, it affects morale quite a lot. But what we saw in the nurses and doctors was that they were staying at it. They tell us that, you know, if I get sick and nobody comes to work to take care of me, then I die. So I'm here to take care of the people who do have infections.
Even not being paid?
Yeah. Well, they feel it's their duty to do that.
Wow. So finally, and you touch on this in your frontline report, Martin, how do Yemenis talk about this war and what they know about the U.S. role there?
Well, the people that we talked to weren't particularly taking sides in the war. They simply felt that they were caught in the middle between the Houthi rebels and the Saudi bombing campaign. But they do know where the bombs are coming from, where the weapons are coming from. They're coming from the United States or from the UK. And, you know, in a number of cases, we had people showing us the shards of a missile or a cluster bomb, and they were from the West. They know the sale of these weapons to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE, the Emirates. They know that those sales are coming from the UK and the US. So when we were there, there was a big rally being held, Say No to US Terrorism. So Americans may not know that the United States is engaged in a war in Yemen, but the people of Yemen know that the U.S. is.
What kind of reaction did you get when Yemenis would find out you're American?
Well, I think people in these countries are so used to there being a difference between the people of the country and the government of the country. And so they make a great distinction between Americans and the American government because their governments are not particularly representative across the region. So they make that same assumption about the U.S. And so they were very friendly to me. They were very happy to have an American reporter there, which is a rarity over the last 8 to 10 months. And they were very pleased that somebody was there to listen to them from the United States. So they were very, you know, they didn't take out their hostility, even though there were chants of death to America and graffiti everywhere you turned.
Martin Smith reported on Yemen for Frontline. You can see what he discovered at our website, PRI.org. Martin, thanks very much.
Hey, Marco, thank you.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on the world, we remember June Foray, the voice of Rocky and Natasha from the Bullwinkle cartoons, and a consummate actress.
When you do cartoons, you often have to have a 2 or 3-way conversation with yourself playing multiple characters. And by changing the physical from one character to the other, you don't blend them. And June was a master at this.
That's coming up right here on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If I had to choose one word that sticks out for me from all the news stories this week, wow, several come to mind. So much news, right? But for me, I guess the word of the week is jamboree, as in that Boy Scout jamboree on Monday in West Virginia, where Donald Trump dropped a few of his own words and themes not really appropriate for a jamboree. Yep, some 40,000 scouts and others walked smack dab into a PG-13 presidential speech. But beyond that, the dictionary defines jamboree as a gathering, usually of scouts, that is often boisterous. Well, between that scout rally, the failure of the Obamacare repeal, and the daily shrapnel from the Russia investigation, I'd say this week's been quite the boisterous jamboree. Anyway, that's my word of the week. We asked a few reporters around the globe to give us their words of the week, and here's what we got back.
My name is Anna Nemtsova. I'm a correspondent for the Daily Beast in Moscow. And the word of the week in Russia is sanktsii, which means in Russian sanctions. Everybody's talking about the new sanctions that the US Congress approved against Russia. People are angrier with Washington's policy than they used to be, and people are worried about the state of Russian economy in the future, about their salaries and their pensions. So it is an unstable situation for many people right now.
My name is Marcela Turati. I am a reporter in Mexico. And the word of the day is cartel, which is the same word in English. This is because right now they are having discussions after a murder of a drug lord in Mexico City called El Ojos. And there is people arguing if there is a cartel in Mexico City, others are calling just a criminal group.
My name is Kim Cloutier. I live in Cape Town, South Africa, and I think the word of the week is corruption because the South African government, and particularly its president, Jacob Zuma, have been embroiled in this scandal with the Indian family called the Guptas, and corruption has been at its absolute core. And evidence has emerged that the family has a stake in key state enterprises in South Africa, and there's been backhand payments going to the president and his coterie, and in fact, South Africans have just had enough.
I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai, India, and the word of the week is cricket queens. Two words compounded with a hashtag, and it's what everybody's talking about in India, where cricket is our religion. On Sunday, we had the World Cup, and the Indian women's cricket team advanced to the finals, shocking everybody. Nobody expected it, and they lost by 7 runs. But what's happened is that they've raised their profile so much that our country, which knows every single cricketer's name from like the 40s till now, but always only the men, has now started to recognize all the Indian women players. They know things like, oh, Harmanpreet doesn't like sandwiches and that's all she's been getting for breakfast in England. And it's really opened up a conversation about fair wages, about equal opportunities in all kinds of areas, not just sport. And it's fantastic.
That was Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai, India. We also heard from Anna Nemtsova in Moscow, Marcela Turati in Mexico City, and Kim Cloutier in Cape Town, South Africa. They each told us about the words that they've spotted in the news cycle this week in their countries. Speaking of words, I'm here in the studio with
Nina Porzuki
and Lydia Jean Cott.
LJ and Nina are here to talk about this week's episode of The World in Words, our podcast about language and culture.
Yeah, and Marco, to do this, I got us some props.
Wow. Edible props.
Fortune cookies. I'm so psyched. I love fortune cookies because you never know what you're going to get, right?
Yeah, that's true. And this week on the podcast, Lydia Jean explores the backstories to how fortune cookies became synonymous with Chinese food in America.
It's a history that involves a lot of stolen fortunes.
Wow. Okay, that sounds really intriguing. First, though, I got to open up my fortune cookie, which is a two-toned fortune cookie.
Three-toned.
It's three-tone. Pumpkin, chocolate, and plain. And the fortune says, pumpkin. It's in your moments of decision that your destiny is shaped. Well, that's deep.
They always are. They always are, Marco.
Wait, that's true, though.
It is true. And this is where we're going to shape the destiny of the show's next few minutes. The question I have is, why? Why? Why are fortune cookie fortunes rarely fortunes like the one I just got?
Marco, I had the same exact question.
And I went to New York City to ask a fortune writer that.
All right. Let's listen to an excerpt from the podcast.
We're not actual fortune tellers. What we like to do is just to give people advice and possibly make them smile.
That's James Wong. He's in his mid-40s, and he's so smiley. He became the official fortune writer at Wonton Food, the biggest fortune cookie company in the U.S., in December. The writer before him, Donald Lau, he had to step down because he said he got writer's block. And writing fortunes, it's actually, okay, it's really hard because the fortunes, they have to apply to everyone. They have to be positive, and there has to be no possible conceivable way that they could be construed as offensive. Otherwise, people complain. The people in the restaurant complain to the restaurant owners, who complain to the distributors, who complain to Wonton Food. So that's why. It's bad for business. Still, even though Wonton tries really hard with all of their messages to be basically keep everyone happy, there have still been fortunes that have gone really wrong.
This one that immediately comes to mind.
A couple, a husband and wife, went up for dinner and they opened their cookies together.
The fortune that he got was romance is in the air on your next trip.
Romance is in the air on your next trip. Unfortunately, he was about to leave on a business trip.
We heard from the lady's lawyer that she's actually blaming everything that happened, that went wrong with the marriage on us.
That can't be true, Lydia Jean. That is insane.
Okay, Nina, I said that. I told them I didn't think it was true. But they insisted that it was. It was him and a PR person that was there. And they said that fortune ended up getting removed from circulation because of it. Anyways, regardless, the story definitely indicates the stakes. People take their fortune seriously. And Wong says that when he's writing, it helps him to think about his daughter. She's 10 years old, and he just thinks about what he wants her to know about life. He had an example, actually, that he dug out of his pocket.
I'm going to take out a fortune that I was
preparing for this interview, if I could find it?
The only sure thing about luck is that it will change.
Oh, that, I don't know, that one seems rather bittersweet to me.
See, like, I think it's nice because it means that, like, when stuff goes wrong, it will also change.
Okay, I see your point.
Anyways, Wong is always writing. He jots down fortunes on gum wrappers, napkins. Sometimes he told me, this is kind of gross, toilet paper.
Oh, my gosh.
And the hardest part, he said, is keeping up with the demand.
I've been being pressured to be more productive, to write more. It's not as easy as probably some people would think.
Wonton produces 4.5 million fortune cookies a day. Like, can
million?
You, yeah. I mean, I can't really conceive of that number, but the demand for new fortunes, I think, might outstrip the number of positive universal messages that it's possible to come up with.
Oh, it's a really troubling problem.
And that might explain why fortune cookie fortune theft might be tempting.
And this week, Marco, you can hear about a case of fortune cookie theft.
Plus, find out where fortune cookies actually originated.
Hint, it's not China.
Check out the World in Words podcast.
Yeah, you can get the World in Words on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcatcher you use. LJ and Nina, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
Thank you. And by the way, guys, send us your favorite fortunes on Twitter. We're at PRI The World.
Yeah, even if it means going out for Chinese and eating 100 cookies till you get a good one.
That doesn't seem like a bad assignment.
Not at all. Are you going to eat that cookie already?
Yeah, sorry.
Hey. Okay. You going to share?
That cookie was good. We've been following the government program known as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's the one that lets undocumented young people or dreamers who came to the U.S. as kids work here legally without fearing deportation, at least temporarily. But it's under threat, and it has DACA recipients really nervous. That's about 250,000 people, people like Eric Silva Palacios, a high school teacher in California. The World's Monica Campbell met up with him recently in San Jose.
Eric Silva Palacios is at his kitchen table, glued to his laptop. He's watching Dick Durbin, the Democratic Illinois senator, hold a press conference.
We believe that those who were brought to the United States as children, have grown up in this country, have no criminal record, who are prepared to serve this country in a variety of ways, should be given that chance to make America a better nation.
Durbin and a bipartisan group of senators are reintroducing the DREAM Act, and it would help people like Eric. He's 23 years old and came to the U.S. from Mexico when he was 5, without papers. This legislation would give him a path to citizenship. Eric also knows the DREAM Act, it's a long shot, but this show of support means a lot right now.
The timing couldn't be any better. There's been a lot of talk about how a lot of different states and a lot of different senators are putting pressure on the Trump administration to get rid of DACA.
DACA status is what lets Eric breathe easier and not fear deportation so much. He's had it since 2012 when Barack Obama introduced it.
DACA gives us a social security number. It allows us to get jobs. It allows us to get driver's licenses in certain states.
But DACA is under fire. Candidate Trump said he'd end it on day one. But as president, he's given mixed signals and it's still chugging along. Now, Texas, Alabama, and other Republican-led states warn they'll sue the government if it doesn't end DACA by September. They say it rewards people who come to the U.S. illegally, and it's unconstitutional. It's a threat with teeth, and the Trump administration isn't showing it'll defend DACA. It's keeping Eric on a roller coaster that's just getting more intense.
We've seen a lot of other marginalized communities get hit hard, and we're kind of just like, not sure when our turn is going to be. So it's a completely different feeling. You don't feel as safe anymore. It always feels like we're tiptoeing our way to 2020 or tiptoeing our way to hopefully a new president.
Some days, Eric just wants to hide from the news.
Sometimes you just have to, like, turn the other way, and that doesn't mean that you've given up. It doesn't mean that you don't care anymore. It means for right now, I'm just going to keep my sanity. I'm going to keep my cool.
But on others, like today, he wears a certain T-shirt. Black with big white letters.
My shirt says undocumented, unafraid, and unapologetic. Some might say that I committed a crime, and so I'm like boasting about committing a crime. I think it's just me putting a face to the name. I think a lot of the times people who might not be super in support of things like DACA and the DREAM Act don't necessarily know somebody who's experiencing it or who is going through that.
It's taken a while for Eric to feel this confident. He's always known he was undocumented.
We crossed in a car with fake documentation. So we pretended to be asleep, and they presented documentation of other U.S. children.
He knew he had to be careful.
Growing up undocumented is something that you can't even imagine. Anytime you pass by a police car, it's duck. So as kids, we learned to avoid police. We learned to be wary.
Last May, Eric graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in the same class as Tiffany Trump.
I actually graduated with Donald Trump's daughter. Donald Trump's daughter sat four people down from me at our commencement ceremony.
Donald Trump, in the same audience as Eric's dad, an undocumented construction worker from Mexico.
Just seeing my dad in the audience and seeing Donald Trump in the audience, I felt like I was able to give my parents the biggest thank you I could give them.
He also realizes that plenty of people think he should go back to Mexico. Eric tells me about a conversation he had in Wisconsin with a friend's mom who voted for Trump.
She just asked me about what I do, all that jazz. And I think by the end of the conversation, she realized that you don't necessarily hear about undocumented immigrants who are working and like contributing to society, because that's not going to drive the message forward of us being bad people. The question she asked that I was curious about was, why can't you go through a process that'll make you a U.S. citizen? And that always seems to be like such an easy option to somebody who isn't undocumented. Just like, well, just get in line. But it's backlogged. They're still working on cases from like 1996.
Was she surprised when you told her that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's like, how can that be, you know?
How do you see your future in the United States?
I want what everyone else wants. I want the nice house, a white picket fence, the dog.
His parents, they got tired of being undocumented and returned to Mexico. His dad 3 years ago, his mom this year. So Eric is on his own, living with fellow teachers, and he shows me his favorite part of their house, the front yard.
There's literally a white fence and a palm tree.
A palm tree, a lawn, a picket fence. Home, he hopes, for good. For The World, Monica Campbell, San Jose, California.
A quick preview now for a story we'll have for you next week here on The World. It's one woman's story from Birmingham, England. Her son was 19 years old when he left home to go fight with ISIS militants in Syria. She was devastated, understandably. But even after her son reached Syria, he kept in regular touch with his family via phone calls and Skype. And at one point, his mom noticed a change.
He was very clingy with me, even more so than usual. Even though he'd have a conversation with me, he would want me to come back on the phone after his father or his sisters had spoken to him. But also then he had a conversation with his sister, and he said to his sister, his older sister, you know, if I'm wrong about this decision, ask God to guide me away from it. So it was almost like something had started to kind of feed into him that actually he wasn't 100%, because quite often these jihadis and these fighters see things very black and white, and he was beginning to start to see gray again.
You may not know her name, but you probably know her voice. Here, take a listen.
We're going to take Washington.
Darling, that's not hard.
No.
Look at headline.
Boston takes Washington 7-2.
Anybody can take Washington.
Yes, Natasha, apparently anybody can take Washington. June Foray, best known as the voice of Natasha and Rocky from The Bullwinkle Show, died this week at the age of 99. In the entertainment world, she was known as the first lady of animated voicing because she did so many other voices, including the granny who always scolded Sylvester the cat when he was trying to make a meal of Tweety Bird. That made June Foray a role model to many others who dreamed of being the voice of a moose or a dog or an alien. Voiceover actor Bob Bergen is one. He's now the voice of Porky Pig. Bob, thanks for being here. How'd you meet June?
I met Junie when I was a kid. I was 14, and I had just moved to L.A. with my family, and I saw on the news that this organization called ASIFA was doing an animation festival at a local mall, and I went there. They were doing a live performance reading of a Rocky Bullwinkle script with June and Bill Scott and Dawes Butler, And I brought my little tape recorder with me, and I met her, and we became really good friends. I told her, you know, at 14, I said, look, I want to be Porky Pig one day. And she said, well, that's taken right now, but you need to study, become a good actor. And, you know, when I was 18, I got my first agent, and it happened to also be her agent, and started working. And eventually, in 1990, I did a show called Tiny Toon Adventures, which was the first project after Mel passed away. And I did Tweety to her granny.
Mel Blanc, the great voiceover actor. Yeah, so I'm kind of almost shocked that at the age of 14, you had an idea that you could be the voice of a cartoon character.
Oh, I wanted to be Porky Pig since I was five.
So it goes way back.
well, it wasn't my Jewish mother's dream, let me tell you. But, but you know, I just was kind of driven. And, you know, living in L.A. where the cartoons were done, I had access to the creme de la creme in the world of animation.
So we found this video on YouTube of June Foray talking about how she came up with the voice of Natasha and Rocky mm-hmm. after she had a conversation with Jay Ward, the show's creator. Let's just listen to that.
I said to Jay, well, how do you want Rocky to sound? He said, just an all-American boy. So I made him an all-American squirrel. And I said, well, what do I do about Natasha? And he said, well, she and Boris come from Pottsylvania. They don't come from Russia. So don't make her Russian, real Russian, you know. Make her sort of continental. So that's what I did. And she turned out fine.
Yeah, I'll say. So, Bob, you must have seen June at work. What can you share with us about June Foray's process? Like, where did she go in her mind to come up with the voice of this Russian, not Russian spy?
Well, let's first start with June comes from the days of radio, where they used to perform live with a live audience. So I never saw June at a cartoon session where she didn't look like she was dressed to go out for the evening. She always looked impeccable with jewelry. I mean, one of the reasons I love voiceovers is because I wear jeans and a baseball cap and don't shave. And in walks the royalty June since the first day I ever worked with her, looking like she was going out on the town. If you watch videos of June, and I teach animation voiceover now, and I teach my students this, that if you physically play the characters, the voice will follow. So if you watch her playing Rocky, if you watch her playing Natasha, it's not a voice, it's a character. And you can see the facial expressions and the body language changing. When you do cartoons, you often have to have a two or three-way conversation with yourself playing multiple characters. And by changing the physical from one character to the other, you don't blend them. And June was a master at this. I don't even think she thought about what she was doing in her process. It was just organic.
So when you saw her, like, in the sound booth, did she, when she started doing Natasha, did she suddenly look like a Russian?
She did. And when she did Rocky, she kind of puckered her face like a little boy. So she got that little boy sort of like, you know, it changes it doesn't change the voice. It changes the way you speak. And then she added that falsetto.
Bullwinkle, you can't do that.
I'm supposed to help ladies in distress.
But Chapter 3 says you never throw a game.
Well,
for June, like any successful cartoon actor, it's all about character and acting.
How big an influence do you think June was, or rather her voice, her character of Natasha, was on just how we see Russia today?
Oh, it's interesting. Without a doubt, it's a stereotype. You know, what she's playing is a characterization, but it's the characterization we all have in our head. I think anybody auditioning for a Russian character today, whether it's a cartoon or a game, especially a female character, all the ladies are going to go to that reference of Natasha because that's where that little thing lives in our mental Rolodex.
So I mentioned June Foray's role earlier as Granny, the owner of Sylvester the Cat.
Can't take my eyes off you for a second. Let me warn you, Sylvester, for absolutely the last time, if there's one little feather, just one little feather harmed of this bird, I'm going to sell you to the violin string factory. Remember?
And Bob, you played Sylvester's tormentor, Tweety Bird. What was it like to work together?
Kind of magical. I remember our very first session, and there were these partitions on each side of the actor, kind of like a sound barrier. And June was like 4 foot nothing. She was a little bitty thing. And I was doing Tweety, and I could, you know, I could feel there was something above me. And I looked up, and it was June standing on her chair looking down at me. And she said, Bob, I swear to God, I thought it was Mel. Which was the nicest compliment anybody had ever given me. And trust me, none of us who do these characters today come close to Mel Blanc's genius. But, you know, she couldn't have said a nicer thing.
And if the lesson from June is to act like the character, not just voice them, were you getting like all small and like wing-like as Tweety Bird?
Well, I will say, when I do Tweety,
My eyebrows raise and I get real peppy. And even when I do Porky, I get like a little pig-like. I just keep my pants on.
You know, and June must have known, that when these cartoons go overseas, they get dubbed into local languages. Did she ever object to having, like, the Natasha voice bungled in a place like France or Brazil? Or would she have even noticed or known?
Oh, I'm sure she noticed, because she was a world traveler. You know, you want these characters to live on. I've seen the Italian Porky Pig, and the guy who does Porky Pig in Italian also dubs, for some reason, David Schwimmer on Friends, which I thought was fascinating. But yeah, it's the characters, and you want them to live on for everybody. But nobody here takes it personally that they were dubbed, because, my gosh, there's a language barrier. They have to be.
Bob Bergen, protege and friend of the late June Foray. She was the voice of Natasha and Rocky and so many other adorable animated characters. Bob, thanks so much for remembering June with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend, everyone. Wait, one more thing. So this is the last interview on the show today. I think you can guess what I'm going to request of you here at the end of the show.
I have no doubt.
Can you help
us out?
Are
you ready?
Yeah.
This has been fun, Andy. That's all, folks.
PRI, Public Radio International.